This is program number 17 of the Does God Exist audio series. John Clayton is your speaker. We've talked about evolution in this series, and we've talked about God and his way of functioning in the history of the creation process. Was God a magician or is God an engineer? We've also talked a little bit about some of the claims of atheists that God is malicious and unjust. And probably this subject, the flood of Noah, combines all of those things together in asking, did it happen? Why did it happen? How did it happen? What should we believe about it? Our basic premise has been to say to you that science and faith are not enemies. They are friends. They support each other. They reinforce each other. They exist in a symbiotic relationship, each mutually beneficial to the other. And one of the things we've tried to do in these discussions is to point out that most of the time when there's a conflict, there's either bad theology or the other choice is bad science. And there's been a lot of both. I sometimes call this lesson the flood of Noah fact and myth. There's a lot of myth out there. A lot of human contrivances used to try and justify a denominational viewpoint of some issue. We've talked about dispensationalism and how it dominates discussions about the age of the earth. And one of the tools that they have incorporated in trying to defend their creed has been the flood of Noah. Sometimes there's been some very bad science involved in that attempt, and we want to look at some of that. The first point that I'd like to make about the flood of Noah is that there are mechanisms for the flood. The Bible indicates two mechanisms, Genesis 7 and verse 11. The same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. Is that a description of something that actually happened, or is it just nice poetry? Well, one of the things that I have to say, and this is not a smart aleck response, but I wasn't there. There is some evidence, but the degree to which that evidence can be proven to be what actually took place is not clear. It does indicate natural process, however, not a miraculous act. One of those evidences is something called magnetic reversals. And this is an interesting possibility as far as some of the data on the windows of heaven were open. The earth has a magnetic field. What a lot of people don't realize is that magnetic field is extremely important to us. It's part of the design of the earth. Because one part of being around a furnace like the sun is that the sun sends out a lot of debris, a lot of charged particles. In addition to that, interstellar space has lots of charged particles. Those particles could be very detrimental to life upon the earth, were there not some kind of a shield around the earth to protect it. And that shield is the earth's magnetic field. Charged particles will respond to a magnetic field. And so the earth's magnetic field repels charged particles away from where people live. And so these belts of protective magnetic coating, called the Van Allen radiation belts, are vital to our existence. Particles coming from the sun or from outer space are trapped in the Earth's magnetic field, and a huge percentage of them come in along the North and South Pole, which incidentally is the cause of the auroras, the Northern Lights and the Southern Lights. What's interesting is that we are very sure that in the history of the Earth, there have been times when the Earth's magnetic field has flipped. I have a lab I used to do with my high school kids. We used to wade out into Lake Michigan and take a sample of the floor of the lake. The sand around Lake Michigan is full of a little material called magnetite, naturally magnetic rock, and there's little flecks of it. You stick a magnet in the sand and it comes up covered with these little flecks. And in situations where you can look at where the flecks are, they tend to line up with the Earth's magnetic field. The interesting thing is that in many places around the world, these magnetic flecks change. You'll have one direction on the surface, which is pointing to the present Earth's magnetic field, but down deeply, they will point the opposite direction. This is called a magnetic reversal. The magnetic field of the Earth has reversed many times. In the Atlantic Ocean, we have some 23 different magnetic reversals. places where you can actually determine that the Earth changed from North Pole to South Pole magnetically and back. How much time that took, how much time there was between the reversals is something we cannot answer, but we can determine the reversals have taken place. Now, as you remember, we discussed the fact that in the situation of the magnetic belts, that they repel charged particles coming from the sun and from outer space. The outermost belt of those particles, because of the light weight of the particles involved, are hydrogen ions, charged hydrogen atoms. Heavier charged particles, like helium, for example, would be located further in because the gravitational pull upon them would be greater. So the Van Allen belts are important, and the magnetic field is important. What is interesting is that geologically we know that these belts have collapsed from time to time. As a matter of fact, on the sun, they do that with a very short cycle. But in the case of the history of the Earth, it's much longer. Now, we don't know how long it took for the magnetic field to collapse. We don't know what the time element was between the magnetic reversals. Right now, it's a very long period of time. But that's not our purpose here. Our purpose here is to point out that when those belts collapse, the particles suspended in the belts, especially the outermost belts, which would in this case be hydrogen, will collapse into an oxygen-rich atmosphere. And hydrogen plus oxygen produces, water. How much water could you get from that? Well, not enough to do what the flood describes. But that's not the only source of water. And it's important to realize that there are many other sources suggested, both scientifically and biblically. One interesting point is that the Glomar Challenger, which is an oceanographic research vessel, has been doing drill coring and dredging. And one interesting thing is that they have discovered that the Mediterranean Sea at one time was an old desert, like Death Valley. When they drill in the middle of the ocean, they come up with pieces of cactus with fauna and flora, which indicate a desert environment. And at the base of the Straits of Gibraltar, there is a normal fault. A normal fault is one where one side drops down relative to the other side. And at the base of that normal fault, there is a huge waterfall gouge. What would that suggest? Well, this would suggest that large amounts of water, perhaps the whole Atlantic Ocean, came across the fault line at the Straits of Gibraltar and pounded into what is now the Mediterranean Ocean. That waterfall gouge is absolutely huge. It indicates massive amounts of water have come across there, measured. The width of the dig out of the gouge is in terms of miles, and the depth is in hundreds and hundreds of feet. So it looks like the whole Atlantic Ocean plowed into that area. And if you draw a line across the Mediterranean Ocean, starting at the Straits of Gibraltar and paralleling the coast of Africa, guess where you end up? In the mountains of Ararat. That brings up another interesting point. The present-day Mount Ararat is not the mountain described in the Bible. If you read the biblical account, the mountain described is in the mountains of Ararat, which is a chain of mountains. And actually, it's quite a few hundred miles away from the present-day Mount Ararat. So there is a mechanism. There is a possibility. Is this the fountains of the deep? Well, that certainly is something to think about. There have been discussions about whether freshwater springs erupted during that time. There are such things. One of the other negative sides of this thing is that there have been those who have proposed what they call the canopy theory. And as I said a moment ago, in this discussion we want to talk about some of the mistakes, some of the myths, as well as some of the facts. The canopy theory sort of built itself off of the Van Allen radiation belts that I talked about. The theory was that the Earth was enshrouded in a canopy, which kept all the nasties out and made the Earth a tropical paradise. Creationists who have used this suggest that that's why we find coal in Alaska, dinosaurs in Alaska, why people live to be 969 years old, because the canopy kept all the nasties out, and that this is what caused the Earth to be a tropical paradise, producing oil and producing the resources in polar areas. There are several problems with that explanation. The first problem is that that's not what causes our climatic difference. Our climatic difference is caused by the angle at which the sun's rays strike the Earth. If we're having a boxing match, and if a boxer gets hit with a punch that hits him perpendicularly, head on, it may knock him out. It'll cause considerable damage. On the other hand, if he turns his head and it's a glancing blow, it won't do much damage. Most of the energy will be dissipated elsewhere. Now, the same thing is true of the energy coming from the sun. In equatorial areas, the sun strikes at right angles, perpendicularly. Therefore, the equator is extremely hot. As you move north and south from the equator, the angle between the sun's rays of strike and the surface of the ground becomes more and more obtuse, in other words, at a greater angle. It bounces off like a glancing blow off the prize fighter we were talking a minute ago. And therefore, at 40 degrees latitude, we don't get as much solar energy as you would at 0 degrees latitude. And that is basically what causes the different climates. The closer you are to the equator, the more vertically, the more perpendicularly the sun's rays are striking, the more energy absorbed and the hotter it is. By the time you get to the poles, the rays are striking at a very low angle, and therefore it bounces off and you have very cold conditions. And that would have been true in a canopy. A canopy is not going to produce a tropical paradise. That's not what causes climatic change. So it's important to not tie magnetic reversals to a canopy theory. And by the way, the suggestion the canopy collapsed and that this is what produced all those changes in man and in man's history, again, is not borne out in terms of the rock record. We see no evidence of such a collapse. And we also see no evidence that the timing would fit the history of man. Now, on the positive side, there are cultural records that do, in fact, support the fact that a flood occurred. And I think this is kind of an interesting point. I was eating in a Mexican restaurant one time, and the placemat was a Mayan calendar. And in the Mayan calendar, near the face in the middle, there's a little section which is called Atonia, and they tell you on the mat it means son of waters. So I got kind of curious and looked this thing up, and it was kind of fascinating what the son of waters is. It says there was a time when man became displeasing to the gods, and the gods decided to send a great flood, which no mortal could survive. But the verdict seemed too harsh to Nukasnina, one of the lesser gods. And so he warned his favorite mortal to build a great ship. Does this sound familiar? Now, this isn't Judeo-Christian tradition. You can't maintain that somehow this is something that was written by people who had been influenced by the biblical record. This is the Mayans. And what's interesting is that every culture in the world has a flood account. I was doing a program one time in the Pacific Northwest with an Indian tribe, and as we walked through the ceremonial area, there was a large pole standing there, and I said to the young man that was bringing me in to make the presentation, yeah, that pole's kind of interesting. That doesn't look like a totem pole. And he said, it's not. It's a flood pole. And I said, what do you mean a flood pole? He says, well, we have a story in our mythology about a great flood covering the whole earth and a guy building a great canoe that... And I said, oh, that sounds like Noah in the biblical story. He said, yeah, very similar. When I was in Alaska, there was a young man who was a Denali who was telling me about the same kind of story, except it was a great raft that was built. And the story goes on and talks about the difficulties in keeping the polar bears away from the seals. And so it is locally flavored, but it nonetheless contains the flood account. Now, you got two choices here. You can either say, well, you know, this whole thing is just a rumor that got around. Well, you know, rumors generally are not global. And while they all have local flavors, they're still global in distribution. The other possibility is that in man's early history, there in fact was a great flood, and all cultures have recorded that event. And I would suggest to you that that is reasonable support for the fact that an event of some sort occurred. Salinity studies are another interesting area that has been used. There was a professor back in the 20th century by the name of Cesare Emiliani, the University of Miami, who did a study of isotope paleoclimatology in the Gulf of Mexico. And he was able to show that there was a radical change in the salinity of the Gulf of Mexico at one point in geological history. where the salinity changed from the normal 35 parts per thousand to a salinity too small to measure. And Dr. Emiliani said that certainly sounds like an addition of massive fresh water added to the Gulf. He proposed the melting of the glaciers as a possibility, and of course flooding could be connected to that as well. I would like to go back to an erroneous suggestion that is made in this area. And again, we're talking about myths as well as evidence. Did the flood cause the Grand Canyon? First of all, let me give you a little geology lesson. There are two kinds of rocks that are of a sedimentary origin. One is called a clastic rock and one is called a chemical precipitate. A chemical precipitate is a rock produced by the chemical combination of materials that produce an insoluble solid material. For instance, when calcium reacts with carbonates in water, we get calcium carbonate, better known as limestone, and it will precipitate out of water. The reefs of the world are, for the most part, made of calcium carbonate. Limestone is calcium carbonate. Dolomite is calcium magnesium carbonate. The other kind of rock that occurs is called a clastic rock. A clastic rock is a rock produced by running water or wind that puts down particles in a deposit. For instance, if mud is laid down, we get a rock called shale. If sand is laid down, we get a rock called sandstone. If gravel is laid down, we get a rock called conglomerate or breccia. Now, the question would be, which kind of rock would be produced by a flood? And I hope that's pretty obvious. If you know somebody that's been flooded, what are they doing? Are they chiseling limestone off the piano? Or are they scraping mud out of the living room? The Grand Canyon is mostly chemically precipitated rocks. There are some shales and sandstones, but the vast percentage of the rocks are chemical precipitate. And it's important to realize that those are not the kind of rocks that would be produced by a flood. It's also interesting to realize that as you go down through the stratigraphy of the Grand Canyon, and we've been taking people on walks and boat trips and stuff down the canyon for many, many years, you see considerable evidence that a flood did not produce it. For instance, when you go down the first rock layer out of the top of the canyon, you go through what is called the Kaibab limestone. This is a chemical precipitate, first of all, but secondly, it has huge quartz crystals called geodes embedded in the limestone. Those quartz crystals have grown over a long period of time. If you had a container that had sugar precipitating out to produce candy, or if you have maple syrup left on the cellar shelf too long and it is producing large crystals, if somebody sat there and stirred it, would the crystals ever form? And the answer, of course, is no. These large crystals in the Kaibab limestone must have been in very quiet conditions when the limestone was produced and the quartz crystals were produced. Further down in the canyon, we come to a rock layer called the Coconino sandstone. The Coconino sandstone is a desert deposit. The particles are laid at the angle that deserts have their particles laid in. The sand grains are frosted, which is what happens when the wind blows them. If they're in water, they're not frosted. There are tracks in the Coconino sandstone. They sink deeply into the sandstone, indicating the animal was walking on dry sand. Under water, buoyancy would hold the animal up, and if there were any tracks at all, they would not sink very deeply. In addition to that, the fossils are a clear indication that the flood did not produce the Grand Canyon. We can go into one rock layer and we can show you one kind of brachiopod called Eospirifer. They have a certain size, they have a certain shape, they have a certain density. 1,000 feet deeper into the canyon, I can show you another brachiopod, which is called Linothyrus. It's the same size, it has the same density, it has the same weight, but there are no Eospirifers in the rock layer that has the Linothyrus. They are completely and totally sorted. Now, is that what a flood would do? Would a flood lay down one clam-like animal at one layer and a different one at a different layer, even though they have the same weight, the same density, and everything else? Or would it make sausage out of the area? If you've ever observed a flood deposit, you know the answer to that question. People try to compare Mount St. Helens to the Grand Canyon. Mount St. Helens is a mountain made of volcanic ash. Very soft, very easily eroded. I've been on it many, many times. Comparing Mount St. Helens with its soft rock with the Grand Canyon made of limestone, which we use as a building stone, is like comparing stainless steel with hot butter. There's no comparison. The point is that the flood did not produce the Grand Canyon. Now, there are still some questions. You know, people will say, well, how do you account for isolated animal populations, like in Australia, for example? I heard one creationist at Purdue University one time explain this by saying, well, Noah sailed his ark over to Australia, gathered his clipboard and said, okay, koala bears, kangaroos, platypuses, out! And then sailed over to Mount Ararat. And of course, the kids are rolling their eyes. The fact of the matter is that there are indications of land bridges. For instance, we know, and have no question about this, that kangaroos have inhabited South America at one time because we find their fossil remains. Is it possible that South America was connected to Australia in the same way that we saw North and South America connected to Europe and Africa? Well, the answer is very clearly yes. So there are some explanations. Was the flood local or global? Well, once again, I wasn't there. But let me point out to you that actually, on the basis of the language, you can't make an argument on this subject. Luke 2 and verse 1, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. Well, did Caesar send tax collectors to the Incas? If he did, I bet they didn't come back. I don't think that's what that's saying. Colossians 1 and verse 23. The gospel of Christ has been preached to every creature under heaven. So was it preached at the bottom of the Grand Canyon? Was it preached to the Denali? To the Incas? If it was, it was phenomenally unsuccessful. It seems to me that Genesis 6 through 8 may very well be referring to all humans on the earth, not to uninhabited islands in the South Pacific or in South America. I don't know how you would answer that definitively. I do think that it's kind of interesting to realize that there is considerable evidence for the flood on a global level. So the facts are, number one, the flood did happen. There's a lot of support for that. And number two, all humans on the earth today are descendants of those who survived it. And that's really all that the flood account is saying. The purpose of the flood account is not to give us a geography lesson or a geology lesson. Is to show the consequences of man rejecting God, refusing to believe in God, choosing to live as he desires selfishly, rather than live as God has called him to live. That purpose cannot be denied. The historical event cannot be denied. But we can argue endlessly about things that the Bible doesn't tell us, and things that are sort of irrelevant to the whole question of the story itself. God is not a magician. God is not deceptive. The flood did happen. We have enough evidence to believe that. But we can't answer every question that someone might raise about how it happened, what took place, and when it took place.